fields on this 10-day trip. For more information, call 217-333-7300 or visit will.illinois.edu/willtravel.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. We'd like to start with some of the week's political news, and we are joined by two people who are going to help us understand what the politicians are saying. Paul Orzelak wrote speeches for President Clinton as well as Al Gore during the 2000 election. He's founder and principal of the strategic communications firm West Wing Writers. Mary Kate Carey was a speechwriter for President George H.W. Bush. She's now a columnist and blogger for U.S. News and World Report, and she's also just produced a documentary. So thank you both so much for joining us once again.
Thanks for having us.
So let's start with a story that's been very troubling for many people. And the investigations into the Department of Veterans Affairs have revealed that some VA hospitals did conceal the number of patients awaiting treatment by creating unofficial wait lists. There are reports that a number of patients died while awaiting treatment on those unofficial lists, although that hasn't been confirmed that it was the cause of death. But at any rate, lawmakers on both sides of the aisle have been demanding that VA Secretary Eric Shinseki, he's a retired four-star general, be held accountable for this. This morning, Secretary Shinseki spoke about this at the National Coalition for Homeless Veterans.
I've initiated the process for the removal of the senior leaders of the Phoenix VA Medical Center. We will use all authority at our disposal to enforce accountability among senior leaders who are found to have instigated or tolerated dishonorable or irresponsible scheduling practices at VA healthcare facilities.
Now, there have been calls, as we said, Paul, on both sides of the aisle for Secretary Shinseki to step down, and the president is under a lot of pressure on this as well. He's actually scheduled to meet with him today, and you apparently think he should resign.
I think he should resign.
Because?
Well, it's about accountable leadership and whether he directly knew about all these things or not, he should step down. But, you know, he's a great soldier, and everybody is, you know, we respect him as a leader. He's not a great reformer. And what the, you know, it's going to take a lot more than a fall guy to fix the VA. There aren't enough doctors. There aren't enough primary care doctors to see people. So, you know, he needs to go.
But that's the question I have. I have to be honest with you. I kind of feel, and I understand that this might be, you know, contrarian, but it just seems like this is more of ritualistic banishment than actually fixing the problem. How does this fix the problem when the whole issue here is that he was lied to?
Well, it's not clear at this point that he was lied to, right? I mean, we still are learning things about the story. To me, it's about accountability. And I think there are a lot of frustration that nobody's been fired in the last six years in this administration, despite some things that went south. There are a lot of people who thought Kathleen Sebelius should have been relieved of her job over the problem with the Obamacare website long before she resigned. It's about accountable leadership. General Shinseki knows that. But it's to the point now where he needs to go.
Oh, what do you think, Mary Kate Carey?
I completely agree that I think not only does he need to go, I think a lot of the leadership at some of these 40 or 42 centers that are under investigation by the IG's office all need new leadership. And one thing to consider would be, you know, it's a tradition to have the head of the Veterans Affairs department be a general like Shinseki is, but maybe we should have be a hospital executive and bring in a healthcare team that knows how to manage what is a massive healthcare system that is failing in our country.
Yeah.
And I don't think that would be crazy. I think that's a great thing Republican opposition could call for is free market reforms. One I saw the other day.
What would that look like?
One I saw the other day, which I thought was a great idea, you've got 21 million veterans. Almost half of them are older than 65. And I think we should consider giving them vouchers. If they don't get seen within 30 days, let's say, why can't they have a voucher to take it for Medicare and go to any doctor in the country that accepts Medicare? I think that's a great way to relieve some pressure on the system and in the long run do what Paul's saying, get more doctors in there, figure out how to get more primary doctors in the VA system. But I think there need to be some free market reforms, not a one-size-fits-all answer for what is a very diverse group of veterans.
I think people go to Medicare. Is that a free market reform?
Well,
I
mean, within that, within the
government
system,
aren't there a lot of Republican governors who don't want to expand these programs?
Well, I think it would be really great. Give them a subsidy to go to any doctor in the country, and the government will subsidize it and let them enter into the private health care system like the rest of us have. I think that would be really great. But
I think, obviously, you know, people want to keep the focus on the people who need this care and aren't getting it, and if you know who've served the country and certainly deserve it. I mean, but the politics, Paul, what are the politics of this? I mean, is the fact that there are people from both sides of the aisle calling for Shinseki's resignation, does that kind of neutralize the politics in any way? Interesting to note, though, that the two leaders of the House, the Speaker and the majority, the leader of the House minority, Nancy Pelosi, to this point, unless they've changed in the last 5 minutes, right, have not been. I mean, because they're making the point that this doesn't really fix it. But does that, what are the politics of this?
Well, the politics of it are that it's a, you know, you don't have to be a Democrat or Republican to see it as a national disgrace that soldiers aren't getting the care they need coming home from war. But the politics, the policy side of this is we don't have enough doctors. Cases are up 50% the last 3 years. We've only added 9% increase in primary care doctors. It's the same problem the system overall is having. So you have doctors who are supposed to see 1,200 cases who are seeing 2,000. They're getting paid 30 to 50% less to begin with. And their bonuses are tied to speed of processing. So it invites exactly the kind of situation that you see. These fixes are going to come from Congress. You know, what if Congress did loan forgiveness for the primary care doctors that are graduating right now to say go into the VA or even the general health system? Only 30% are doing it today because they don't pay as much. It'll make a big difference. Mm-hmm. But there are things the VA can do to streamline their process too. You know, let's work out the medical records issue they're having with the Pentagon. Let's have a more streamlined form process so we're not getting tangled in forms, just like the red tape that's held this agency up for decades.
You know, we have to even actually think about the fact that we're talking about this Veterans Affairs issue. Now, we're about to welcome a whole new generation of veterans back, mm-hmm. to the country as their service winds down and as these campaigns wind down overseas. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about the latest in politics with former presidential speechwriters Mary Kate Carey and Paul Orszag. And this is the other issue here, is that, you know, on Tuesday, President Obama announced plans to remove all troops from Afghanistan by 2016, except for a few that will stick around to defend the U.S. embassy. And then on Wednesday at the U.S. Military Academy's commencement, he talked about his administration's new approach to foreign policy. I just want to play a clip, and it's actually a lengthy clip from his interview with my colleague Steve Inskeep, who spoke with him right after the speech. I just want to play it.
The kinds of issues, though, that dominate the headlines, a conflict in Syria, a Russian incursion into Ukraine, the kidnapping of 200 young girls in Nigeria. In those circumstances, we are going to be most effective when we use a wide range of tools, diplomacy, sanctions, appeals to international law. In some cases, a judicious use of military force may make sense, but in those circumstances, it has to be in a multilateral system where other countries are participating.
So translate, Paul. What's he saying?
He's saying that the United States can't lead and go alone in any of these places. You know, the United States is the one country in the world who people don't ask, what's China going to do about this? Or what's Europe going to do this? They always ask, what's America going to do about this? And it has for 70 years. It's the country that we've been. But, you know, our country right now has a little bit of battle fatigue. We've had two wars. We're thankfully winding down the second one. But, you know, there's an overwhelming, you know, support for the president in not putting troops on the ground in Syria or in eastern Ukraine. You know, the problem right now is that it's, you know, Russia. I mean, Russia fits into a familiar storyline, and now it's, okay, well, do we look weak? I mean, the truth is we're not going to commit troops in all these places. Mm-hmm. Can we do more in these other places? I think we probably can, mm-hmm. but it doesn't mean we haven't done a lot.
Mary Kate, how do you respond to this?
Well, I think he's got the same problem as he has with the previous subject, which was what one observer called the revenge of the stump speech, which is we've got all this material of President Obama, then as a senator even, talking about all the things that are dishonorable about not giving our vets great health care, and it can be used against him in political ads and against the Democrats who are running for office. We've got the same thing here, where you've got the president giving a speech at West Point where his foreign policy sounds very reasonable and balanced and multilateral and all those sort of things, and yet you can go back and pull up him saying, Assad must go, there's a red line in Syria, and then nothing happened.
Does this speech accomplish anything in your view? I mean, you said it, revenge of the stump speech. What are you saying? It's just kind of here to create
It's one
background
more example.
Material for, yeah. for people who are running for office so that they can have a kind of statements to stand on. What are you
yeah,
saying?
There's,
what does it do?
I think what it does is it adds to the narrative that he has a great rhetorical ability to say these statements, and then the actions fall short time after time after time. And we've now got it in, we've got speeches that he's said in Ukraine, Syria, Iran, Afghanistan. I mean, Afghanistan. He talked about the terrible danger of letting the Taliban take over. And then for years, and then he immediately this week announced specific timetable of when we're going to withdraw, which totally tips off the Taliban of when to take over.
What do you think?
I think that there's not a lot of nobility and restraint. It doesn't feel like shining city on a hill stuff that we've always been. But in truth, we've chased al-Qaeda out of Pakistan. We've chased them in places like Yemen. Are they going away anywhere? No, but they go to other parts. But, you know, we've been active in parts of the world to advance our interests. And actually, America is right now doing more in more corners of the world than any time in our history, in places like Africa and Burma and other places which weren't exactly foreign policy priorities before. But because we haven't been active everywhere doesn't mean that this administration hasn't done a lot in a lot of places. And, you know, we could do more in Syria. I believe we could do more in Ukraine, and I think we will. But it doesn't mean that we've somehow been weak or waddling.
Okay, let me just give you a final thought on one on a different topic, which is Edward Snowden. Big interview this week with Brian Williams of NBC. He clearly sees himself as a patriot. Seems like he's kind of winning the public relations battle on this, and yet he still attracts a furious response from people who say that he's, you know, that if he's really a patriot, then he should come home and face, you know, the sort of justice. And I take it that both of you actually agree on this. But Mary Kay, why don't you give you the final thought on this? Your thoughts about it?
Yeah, I mean, I think Snowden was probably well-intentioned, and I think he was very upset about what the government was doing in terms of the Constitution. But the minute he ended up in Russia, that sort of told me all I needed to know. And I think Brian Williams asked him, why did you go to Russia? And he said, because I couldn't get to Cuba. And I thought, well, that's the wrong answer.
Okay. All right.
But anyway, I think he should come home, roll the dice, stand in front of a court of law, and see if he can get a jury verdict to acquit him.
Interesting. Big public opinion divide on this one. Mary Kay Carey was a speechwriter for President George H.W. Bush. Not here, though, but big public opinion divide elsewhere. She's now a blogger and columnist for U.S. News and World Report. And Paul Orszag was a speechwriter for President Clinton. He's the founder of West Wing Writers. They were both kind enough to join us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Thank you both for coming.
Thanks for having us.
Just ahead, people from around the world are gathering to hack for the common good. We'll hear why entrepreneurs, techies, even the White House are taking part in the National Day of Civic Hacking. That's next on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support comes from Bodywork Associates, offering professional, licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Two locations, including inside the Activities and Recreation Center, north of Memorial Stadium on the U of I campus, and on Windsor Road in Champaign. More information is at bodyworkassociates.com.
If you know someone, a friend, relative, or neighbor who's visually or print impaired and would benefit from having access to a completely free 24-hour audio stream of read aloud local, regional, and other publications, including newspapers, please contact Illinois Radio Readers Kathy Spiegel at 217-333-6503 or visit will.illinois.edu/Illinois Radio Reader for more information. The Illinois Radio Reader is a service of Illinois Public Media.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We turn now to an event happening this weekend that will bring software developers, entrepreneurs, local governments, and community members together to design and build tools for the common good. Using publicly released data, they will work together to create all kinds of projects, from fixing potholes to stocking food banks, basically integrating technology to solve community issues. The event is known as the National Day of Civic Hacking. Here to tell us more is one of the organizers, Ted Kozin. He's the founder of Second Muse. That's a collaborative innovation lab that helps find technological solutions to everyday issues. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So back up and tell me, what is civic hacking?
So a civic hacker is really a community member. This can be an engineer, a software developer, a designer, an entrepreneur, sort of really anybody that cares about their community and cares about actually influencing it. And civic hacking is when these folks actually work with each other, including folks within the government, including who are included in that group, to find ways to just improve the quality of life in their communities.
What kinds of projects do you tend to gravitate toward? Because I think some people might be intrigued by this. On the one hand, volunteerism is such a fundamental part of American life. On the other hand, I think some people might say, fixing potholes, that's the government's job. They're supposed to do that. Why should people volunteer to do something that we know that's their job?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. My sense is that because both we know more about what's going on sort of within our communities, and that there's such tremendous capacity, that there's many ways where citizens can actually plug in and provide solutions and ideas, and that traditionally were held within the government, or within, say, for example, some kind of an NGO or something like that. But we see people come up with novel solutions that integrate, these different sort of segments of society that have traditionally been very segmented to come together in really novel ways. And so you see people doing a whole range of things from, building websites that help, that help people without homes find homes for the evening, or people that are hungry find food from, healthy food sources. And that, of course, involves, the government working together to make sure that certain standards are in place, as well as, software programmers to bring their talents from their day jobs to actually, help really solve a problem that exists in the community.
I've seen an example of this up close, after Hurricane Katrina, when a lot of people went up to Houston to find, safety. And a lot of people had to leave so quickly, they didn't have address books, or particularly, seniors who perhaps didn't have, or they perhaps left phones behind where they had numbers programmed in and couldn't find relatives. And I saw, hackers kind of descend upon the stadium there in Houston, where a lot of people were finding emergency shelter, and set up systems right there to help people find relatives and loved ones around the country. It was quite amazing to see, and it was kind of but it was an emergency situation where there literally could not have been a system in place. Can you give us another example of where hackers have gotten together to kind of solve a problem, perhaps on a more ongoing basis, or to solve a more ongoing problem?
Yeah, no, and that's a great example. I think in the aftermath of Katrina is when we saw a real explosion of this kind of people who had a lot to give, but what they wanted to give was not a $5 donation. They wanted to build a website or find a lot of those. Of course, you're referring to one of many person finders websites that popped up in the emergency situation. One of the examples of what we saw come out of last year, for example, was an initiative called OMG Transit. And so, if you're interested in multimodal transportation, that means I want to, use a bus and maybe a car sharing program and maybe a train and then maybe, some other form of transportation. There were no apps to be able to take you from end to end to say, how do I get from point A to point B using the public infrastructure? And this was a group of people that literally just came together. They met each other in Minneapolis, and then they came up with a really interesting sort of application. And then, throughout the course of, the next 6 months, we worked with them actually quite closely. And they're a proper up and running business right now, where they're really building this, and it's been an ongoing year-long initiative.
Edward Snowden is in the news now. We mentioned him just briefly a few minutes ago. What about the fact that NASA and the White House are taking part in this? So some citizens have some not warm feelings about their government right now, feeling that the government's overreached in accessing information about citizens that they should not necessarily have access to. Are you at all concerned about privacy issues or breaking down walls, not just for the government or for private sector players who are getting access to information they really shouldn't have about people? Is that at all a concern?
Yeah, I think that that's clearly a concern, and we're seeing it play out. I think that what we're seeing is that, there's been this really big explosion of data, and people have access to lots of data about people. And we're having a really interesting conversation right now about what information should you have access to, what information shouldn't you have access to. I think that what we focus over here is not necessarily on saying we should open up data that is questionable in terms of whether we should have access to it or not. What we're really focusing on is inaccessible yet acceptable data. So NASA, for example, generates tons of data. through other satellites, both looking into space, as well as they have a lot of satellites that are looking at Earth, looking at climate change patterns and things like that. I think what we're interested in is taking data that everybody agrees is not innocuous, but is not sort of within this realm of conflict about should this data be available or not. And we're actually just making this accessible. So you have 18 different federal agencies that are involved that are opening up data sets, and this is not controversial data. This is sort of data that nobody would object to, but that is maybe sitting in a corner and actually is not being used well, and that's really kind of the data that we're focusing on.
You know, you're telling us that there are events all over the country. What, there's something like over more than 100 events, right, taking place this weekend?
That's right. Yeah, there's 100 and about, I think we're up to 123 events in 103 different cities.
And what are some of the things that you like about it? And I know that one of the things you were telling us is that this is the kind of event that brings together people who don't normally sit in a room together, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, because of the fact that the difference between what should the government be doing versus what should the private sector be doing versus what should a community volunteer be doing, because they've gotten so intermingled, you know, a lot of times, I mean, we can sort of clash and say, this is your job, this is my job, or we can get into the room together and actually see each other face to face and meet each other. And that diversity of opinion from so many different multiple backgrounds, when it's coming together for the intent of actually understanding some kind of a challenge or opportunity and then working together to fix it, has turned out to be very powerful. And we have, you know, a library of evidence of, you know, of what that is able to create. And it's really rich what comes out of there, just because I think it's not an antagonistic meeting. It's a really it's a very additive, a very constructive sort of an event.
How will you judge the success of this, you know, overall? If you and I get together 5 years from now, what do you hope will have happened as a result of the work that's going on this weekend and around the country and around the world?
I think that there's probably a number of factors. I think that we want to see real stuff happen. So we want to see, you know, not something that happens over a weekend and then sort of disappears, but we want to see, you know, kind of what you alluded to earlier, which is ongoing initiative that actually is helping people, that is actually solving challenges, that's starting new businesses. We also want to see this influence, and we're already seeing it really influence both local government as well as federal government in terms of their ability to, because there's a lot of data there. And again, we're talking about we're talking about data that's not controversial, but we're seeing a lot of people open that up. And I think that watching more of that is going to be one of the factors of success.
Todd Kozane is the co-founder of Second Muse. We've been talking to him about events this weekend around civic hacking. And to learn more, you can go to npr.org/tellmemore. Todd, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Michelle.
Now we want to dig a little deeper on a story that we've been following closely. That's that shooting in Santa Barbara. We spoke earlier this week about the nearly 140-page manifesto the shooter, Elliot Roger, left before he killed six people. He said he resorted to violence because women weren't attracted to him, and he was disgusted by, quote, outgoing, boisterous jocks. Blogger Arthur Chu says what he heard in the manifesto was not so far off from what he's heard many times from other so-called nerds and in the media. And in fact, this is such a widely accepted storyline, it's a cliche. Shy, awkward, but lovable guy chases hot girl crush. In the movie version, he eventually wins her over. But Arthur Chu says we, nerds and everybody else, need to rethink this storyline because it can actually be uglier than it sometimes seems. Arthur Chu wrote about this for the Daily Beast in a piece called Your Princess is in Another Castle, Misogyny, Entitlement, and Nerds. And he is with us now. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And let me just start by saying you come by your nerd credentials honestly, and I mean this with the utmost respect. You are the 11-time Jeopardy champion. For people who are wondering where they've heard that name before, that is you. And you are a blogger and an actor and a comedian. You know, with that being said, what gave you the idea for this piece? Is this something that came to you right away, or is this something you'd been thinking about for a while?
Well, the issue is something I've been thinking about for a long time. It's been a part of my life for a long time. I think if most people from my background, most, you know, introverted, gifted guys who grew up in a certain culture would acknowledge that this has been an issue for a long time. But it really struck me after first the shooting itself, the news of the shooting, and then the response, you know, on Twitter was primarily, you know, it was a hashtag, Yes All Women, which was a response to Not All Men, which was this ongoing conversation online where over and over again, women have been telling their stories about being victimized and guys don't want to hear it. A guy like Elliot Roger, we want to other him, to make him a monster, someone who is completely unlike ourselves. And I feel like we need to own up to the fact that there's this undercurrent in our culture of entitlement when it comes to women that, you know, provides the motivation, it provides the context for a seriously ill person like Elliot Rodger to do what he did and think what he did.
I mean, you said in the piece that you expected Elliot Rodger's manifesto to be incomprehensible madness. But, you know, you write, quote, "The overall problem is one of a culture where instead of seeing women as, you know, people, protagonists of their own stories, just like we are of ours, men are taught that women are things to earn, to win." And you say, "We male nerds are force-fed this script." Talk a little bit more about that.
A lot of guys who, for whatever reason, have not had much success in dating, don't have a girlfriend, you know, the term on the internet is incel, involuntarily celibate, and they kind of medicalize it and make themselves into a community. They feel like they are owed a sexual relationship with a woman or their life is incomplete. And the problem is, you know, that's not a thing someone can give you. Someone can give you money. No one can just give you a woman. Women aren't a thing to be given. Every individual woman you meet has a choice whether or not to want to be in a relationship with you. And I will say, we put a lot of shame on, you know, lonely guys. And I don't want to make this about, like, bashing, you know, nerdy guys like some people have said that I did. But when you are suffering, it is very hard for you to see outside your own suffering. And so these guys, you know, and I've been there too, blame women and say, like, women, as though they're the monolithic group, should be doing this. I'm owed this. I'm owed a relationship. I'm owed sex.
Can I just stop you for a minute here? Because one of the things I read in your piece, though, is kind of a counter manifesto to nerds to say, now that we're at the center of the culture, we need to step up. You know, we're not the victims anymore, right? I mean, one of the things you say, and I need to edit a little bit the language, but you say, what did Elliot Rodger need? He didn't need to get laid. None of us nerdy, frustrated guys need to get laid. When I was and use a word here, a-hole, with rants full of self-pity and entitlement, getting laid would not have helped me. He needed to grow up. We all do. And part of what you're saying is, look, now that nerds are in ascendancy, now that we worship, you know, Steve Jobs and we need, you know, tech gurus, that people who have traditionally seen themselves as victims, they need to take some responsibility for their behavior and kind of think anew about these things? Is that part of what you're saying here?
It is true that this persecution narrative, it's particularly hard to sustain now. It's just, it's beyond ridiculous that the tech industry is lauded by all the major publications, that everyone worships at the feet of the internet, everyone wants a piece of that dollar, and we're still saying that people should be given a pass because they are, you know, quote unquote, nerds, that we are the underdogs. And not being able to see how in someone else's story you could be the bad guy, that other people don't exist to be your supporting characters. And a lot of girls who were in these subcultures where they had a lot of guys who grew up with this victim complex, you know, it's almost like there is a sense of entitlement that, I'll put it bluntly, like, oh, the cheerleaders didn't accept me, so you have to. And if even you reject me, then the world is so unfair, I'm going to kill myself. This is like a narrative that plays out in high schools across the country. And a lot of women that I know have grown up with this, the sense of duty. And that's what's messed up about it, that it's like your duty to go help guys. That sense of duty is this very oppressive thing for a lot of women to grow up with.
I have to be honest with you that I have been hearing in the last couple of days from male colleagues and acquaintances of mine who have said similar things, which is to say, up until the part where he decided to say he was going to kill everybody and punish these people for not, you know, serving his interests, that could have been me. You know, that sense of being angry and having a sense of entitlement that, hey, I got good grades. I have top SAT scores. I should be getting the girls, you know, that kind of thing. A number of people have said that could have been me. I wanted to know for you, because you said this, what was your light bulb moment? When did it go off for you that that was messed up?
There wasn't a single light bulb moment. You know, I was friends with my wife for a long time before we actually started dating. And, you know, hearing her stories about what it was like to be sexually harassed about, you know, and not necessarily, you know, I think when they said, yes, all women, it's because all women have some story. And if you just listen to those stories and you listen to what it's like on the other side, when you are reaching out, you're trying to grab that validation, that comfort from women, and you're making those demands, it feels like you're in such pain and that your needs are so paramount. And then flip it around and look at it from the perspective of the person of whom those demands are being made, the person who's expected to fix you. The thing that really made me angry, you know, Elliot Rodger's gone. I can't be angry at him, but there's all these men who want to just say he was crazy, that he was a monster, and now he's dead, and so the problem is over, and we can move on with our lives. And I do not want us to move on with our lives. I want us to talk about this. You know, I want this to be public. And there was some very brave people on Twitter who started this ball rolling, and it's been this big, big, big conversation. And I'm very flattered that my piece has gotten so much attention. But, you know, ultimately what the story is about and what I want to focus on is that women are telling their stories and guys aren't listening, and that's what I want to tell my fellow men to do. So just listen, hear what the things that you do as a man sound like and feel like, what the experience of that is like from the other side. And just think about that the next time you're in a situation where you feel that sense of, you know, resentment, entitlement, all of those emotions.
Arthur Chu is an actor, comedian, and blogger, and 11-time Jeopardy champion. His piece for the Daily Beast is called Your Princess is in Another Castle, Misogyny, Entitlement, and Nerds. And he was kind enough to join us from member station WCPN in Cleveland. Arthur Chu, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Coming up, we'll talk a bit more about accused Santa Barbara shooter Elliot Rodger, and we'll ask the barbershop guys if these narratives about the geek getting the girl are really damaging. And we'll also talk about what we can learn from the tragedy. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Kauffman Foundation, educating startups through the Kauffman Founders School, online at entrepreneurship.org. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems at pewtrusts.org. From the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And from the estate of Joan Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio. This is NPR.
It's almost June, which means you're probably thinking about your garden, barbecues, swimming pools. Well, at WILL, we're thinking about June 30th. That's the end of our fiscal year, and we are currently $350,000 short of our fundraising goal. To help jumpstart June, we'll be having a short fund drive starting on Monday, June 2nd. And hopefully you've heard about the challenge on that date. When we raise $20,000, a local couple will donate an additional $40,000. Donate now toward the challenge at will.illinois.edu/junejumpstart.
On the next Fresh Air, Joaquin Phoenix. He stars in the new film The Immigrant, and his film Her is out on DVD. We'll talk about his movies, his life, and his public image, like as an actor who hates to be interviewed.
I will make you another promise. Okay. I promise never to ever make you go through this again.
Actually, he's totally enjoyable in this interview. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support comes from the Yoga Institute of Champaign-Urbana, with instruction in Iyengar yoga and special classes for men, women, 50-plus, knees, low back, neck, and shoulders. New classes start the first week of June. Details at yoga-cu.com or 344-YOGA.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now it's time for our weekly visit to the barbershop where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Sitting in the chairs for a shape-up this week, our writer Jimmy Israel. He is with us from Lexington, Kentucky this week. Corey Dade, contributing editor for The Root, is with us from Philadelphia this week. Lenny McAllister is a Republican strategist and host of Get Right with Lenny McAllister on KDKA News Radio. He's with us from Pittsburgh. And from NPR West, film writer, actor, and producer Rick Nahara. Take it away, Jimmy.
Thank you, Michelle. Hey, fellas.
Hey,
welcome
Jimmy.
To the shop. How we doing?
Oh, we're doing.
What's up,
Jimmy?
Kentucky boy?
Yeah, what's up? Well, you know what? As it happens, Kentucky? It's so weird. I'm actually, everybody knows I'm from Cleveland, right? But, you know, I'm actually in the studio where the barbershop was born, more or less. Remind me to sit you down one day over drinks and tell you that story.
Yeah, then, Grandpa, okay. We want to hear it. Yeah.
Right?
And about how you stuffed newspaper in your shoes to walk to school. Tell us
exactly.
All.
Exactly.
Sounds like this is going to be a Kentucky bourbon story right here.
Right. Back in my day, I had to drive a Chrysler to work. But anyway, let's get it on. And let's continue the conversation we were just having. You know, police say Elliot Roger, a 22-year-old college student in Santa Barbara, went on a violent rampage last Friday that left 6 people dead and 13 wounded before he killed himself, Michelle.
And, you know, he left this very robust video and written manifesto, as he called it. And he said that, I think those of you who have been following this story know this, that he was seeking revenge on women who wouldn't pay attention to him and on guys who had better luck with women. And many of the people he was very angry at were... He was very angry at white women for rejecting him. He was very angry at blacks and Latinos, apparently, who he felt had more social success than he did. And it's important to note that he has been receiving some form of mental health counseling throughout his life. But there's been a lot of talk about some of the bigger issues that prompted this. And I just wanted to ask, since a lot of you know, you all are the people who work in the culture and help shape it. And I wanted to ask what your thoughts were about this.
Well, you know what? I'll jump in at great personal risk and say these hashtag conversations, I guess they're okay, but they're largely just testimony from the pews, in my opinion. You know, it's intellectual street ball with everybody kind of showing off their best handles. But, you know, when you get this kind of play in serious intellectual discourse, I'm not sure if it has any practical value. You know, I mean, whatever happened to just playing crazy, right? Well, why does it have to be Marilyn Manson's fault or, you know, or Steven Seagal's fault? Dude was crazy. And there's no amount of gun legislation, Oprah Chai, or hashtags that's going to make crazy people better people. What we need to do in this order, get your pens out, everybody, is parent our children, correct your friends, and keep an eye on the crazy cats that you hold outside of your crew. But all the rest of that, I'm not sure. You know, for me, I bowed out of those conversations because I also felt that was largely, you know, I've been in this game a minute. And when women are having conversations about sexual assault and this type of thing, it's better that men just listen and stay out. You know, and but I'm just not sure. Like I said, it just occurs to me as testimony from the pews. I'm not sure what exactly is going forward.
Well, I want to hear what the guys have to say, other guys have to say about this, but I don't know, how is it that men should stay out when, in large part, they're the ones doing the raping and the assaulting? I mean, I'm just saying, obviously not all men, but why wouldn't men participate in those conversations? Well, go ahead, Rick, go ahead, do your thing.
No, I mean, I think men have to be in that conversation. I mean, it starts with the perpetrator who really is creating the victim and moving it forward. So men have to be part of that conversation. I mean, I have a wife, 2 daughters, and a mother and sister, and you know, men are involved with women, you know, throughout our lives. But there is that problem of violence, and women do have to deal with fear in a level that men don't understand because we don't deal with it. Unless we showed up in a penitentiary in a dress, we would not experience what women do every day.
I think what Jimmy was mm-hmm. trying to say was not necessarily that men should not participate, but that men should not try to bark up, chime in, etc. Just shut up, sit back, and listen. You're not a woman. Listen to what women go through every single day, and then actually try to learn from your peers on this planet, and then change not only your behavior, but the behavior of men around you. I think that's what Jimmy was going after in that regard. I agree with
him
100%.
Ladies and gentlemen, mark today on your calendar, because Mr. McAllister has my back. Thank you.
I have your back, too. And you know what it is? I believe that men have to be involved in the conversation, but typically men, we try to fix things.
And I'm saying this isn't a situation we can fix. This situation we can fix among each other, and we do. Yeah. Quiet is kept. Well, we do.
Well, let me ask this though about Rick, because Rick is some man is in the biz. I mean, one of the conversations that we just had with Arthur Chu, who's talking about this whole, you know, revenge of the nerds narratives, and there can be something about that can be actually kind of uglier than sometimes we even want to acknowledge that it is. And he highlighted a particular scene. Can I just get your take on this idea?
Well,
I don't know that anybody's saying movies cause people to kill people. I mean, I think but this whole idea that we make it kind of okay by what we put out there. What do you say?
I think a lot of times what we're talking about, I think, is that men are the ones controlling what's happening in film. And it's mostly white men. It's mostly white men in their 20s. And that's not me. It's the Writers Guild of America statistic. And it's not just the Writers Guild of America. I call it the Whitest Guild of America. And so, you know, it's true. And so when you look at it and I go, and I'm a member of the Writers Guild. But the statistics are against the minorities and people of color and women. And because of it, the people that are telling this story happen to be the so-called nerds. And that's their fantasy a lot of times of the nerd's going to get the woman. I mean, I'm on the opposite side. I had a horrible SAT scores and bad grades, and I got women because women are just kind. So I had no revenge at all. And being Latino, I noticed he did shoot some Latino, and it we have the stereotype of we're the Latin lovers. Hmm. And a big part of it is in our culture we really listen to women. You know, as part of we worship it. I'm speaking for my culture right now. So.
I have a problem with this narrative for any number of reasons. I mean, because the nerd has been getting the woman since Cyrano de Bergerac. So, I mean, to throw the creative under the bus, it doesn't seem right to me. I'm sorry.
Can Corey jump in here? Corey Day, do you want to weigh in?
Yeah. No, yes, I would. As a father of a daughter who's, has to raise a daughter, I'm definitely willing to weigh in here. I think, you know, what I heard in what Arthur Chu was saying and Elliot Rodger is a parallel to what we hear from women who are tired of being rejected by men, the resentment and anger that build up in women. The difference is women don't turn into mass killers targeting men or anyone else as a result of that. I think the difference is America has a culture of violence against women that it still is grappling with. I mean, 43% of college-age men admit to having used force to have sex with women and yet don't even recognize it as force. Okay, so let's start there. We need to do a better job of teaching men to deal with rejection from women in a healthy way. But this is the thing that's interesting. When we have these mass shootings, we tend to look for something unique about the mass shooter to explain their behavior. The Alabama college professor who went on a rampage in 2010 was said to be motivated by revenge for being denied tenure. The guy who shot Gabby Giffords and others in Arizona in 2011 was said to be motivated by right-wing political demagoguery. The truth is, with all these people...
It wasn't right-wing, Corey. It wasn't right-wing, actually.
Let me finish.
So, hold on.
Of course
it
wasn't. That's not true.
Okay.
Of course it wasn't. That's exactly my point, Lenny. The truth of the matter is the commonality between all these shooters is anger, resentment, and more than anything else, mental illness. So let's sort of put to the side the societal sort of discourse about rape culture and about violence against women and deal with the mentally ill in an effective way, which is to say, how do we create a more effective legal recourse for parents, for loved ones, to actually stop their mentally ill relatives from doing this?
This isn't about just mental illness, though. This is also about entitlement.
I didn't say
I'm not saying you first and foremost. I'm
okay.
Piggybacking
Go
on
ahead,
what
Lenny.
You said, Corey. I'm not striking what you're saying. I'm piggybacking on it. It's not just about that. Although there is obviously a component to mental illness that is involved here that we have to address. A lot of this, though, is entitlement. This individual that committed this heinous crime last week was also somebody from a privileged background who sat there and told himself, I have the money. I'm from a privileged background. I should be able to get these things. And again, now when you start talking about entitlement, you're talking about accomplishing things, not forming relationships, being peers, having healthy relationships.
Mental illness gloms on to any cultural idiom, okay? Whether it's entitlement or this case, or racial animus in another case, or anti-gay bias in a still other case. Any sort of cultural bias can be something that foments mental illness. Mental illness is at the core of this.
But it doesn't mean that it has to. Every single thing that you think wrong is not a mental illness.
What's your take on what should happen now, Lenny?
He was in therapy.
This goes back to what Jimmy said. This is about parenting. This is about how we treat each other in our society, and it starts in the home.
I don't know. His parents seem to have been very hard to get him some help. I mean,
he also had mental illness issues.
And, so
that's where the mental illness comes into play. But generally speaking, sometimes you got to take your boys aside as a father to a 14, 15-year-old boy like I do with my 14-year-old and remind him, hey, remember how you were holding the door open for your mom and your sister? And this, that is somebody. Mother's future mother, that's somebody's sister right now, and you need to treat her a particular way. And if you're not doing it at 14, why in the world do we think it's going to make any difference at 22 to 24 years old?
Well, you have to teach. I mean, I do it with my son too. The difference between him and his sisters, and explaining things to him of how to treat his sisters, how to treat women differently, the whole thing. I mean, it's you have to teach early on. But I don't think Elliot Rodgers had bad parents. And also, he had a therapist. And he had 6 cops that came to visit him to check him out.
7.
I mean, 7 cops. Okay.
But
seven.
I think why are these trained mental health professionals? I mean, it just seems that there's a lot to say here about how you could respond to these situations.
And Michelle,
with people
and
who
that
go
goes back to my
with
point.
You. Why isn't a social worker or a psychiatrist a part of that kind of SWAT team? Why don't we have mental health SWAT teams?
Yeah.
It seems like we almost meet force with force as opposed to using everything we know about mental health. I mean, why wasn't a social
and
worker
people,
a part of that
people
crew?
Actually, it's interesting, Michelle, you mentioned that, because people actually end up having to resort to the police as an end run around getting their mentally ill loved ones committed by force, because it's so difficult to have that done, especially when you're dealing with an adult, someone who's older than 18. So they often have to go to the police to see if they can get a psychiatric hold, which is what the parents of Elliot Rodgers tried to get done.
Well, 6 police showing up aren't therapists. That's the truth.
Well, obviously there's a lot to talk about, and obviously people have a lot on their minds, and I'm glad I get a chance to get your take on it from all of you. I do want to switch gears just for the time we have left. And if you're just joining us, we're having our weekly Barbershop Roundtable with writer Jimmy Israel, film writer and producer Rick Nahara, journalist Corey Dade, and Republican strategist and talk show host Lenny McAllister. Jimmy, where do you want to go next? Do you want to talk about the NBA playoffs, or do you want to talk about Dr. Dre? We only have about 4 minutes left. Where do you want to go?
We could talk about Dr. Dre.
About Dr. Dre, and we'll just do a quick round. I'll get your take at the end on who you want to win. So Apple is set to buy Beats Electronics for $3 billion. That would reportedly make the 49-year-old producer, rapper, and businessman Dr. Dre the first hip-hop billionaire. So I just want to thoughts. I don't know. What do you think? Thumbs up, thumbs down, happy? Obviously,
happy for him.
Go ahead, Rick.
Really happy for him.
Yeah. Why doesn't he invite us over for a party?
Yeah.
Finally, it's good that someone finally made the money, and it makes sense. You're going to make the money behind the scenes. You're going to make the money as a producer, where rather than releasing one album at a time, you can release 10 at a time and then build your way up in the business world. This makes all the sense in the world to me, and kudos to him.
Kudos to him. Does anybody think it's lame? Yeah.
No, I don't think it's lame. I think it's important to note that he's not making the billion off of his music. He's making the billion off of his brand, which reinforces to me the fact that hip-hop is now a highly marketable, legitimate, bankable brand. And now maybe, he has enough time to get that Detox album out. Come on, Dr. Dre.
All right, well, indulge me a little bit on the playoffs then, all right? So, guess what? I have the mic. I want to talk about the playoffs. Last night, the San Antonio Spurs beat down the Oklahoma City Thunder in Game 5 of the NBA playoffs. The Spurs came out on top, and Kevin Durant of OKC says they're not giving up that easy. Let's want to play it. Here it is.
Mm-hmm. It's been an up-and-down series, but we got to figure out a way to, come with it in Game 6. If we want to get to where we want to get to, we got to win in San Antonio, so... But we got to focus on the next game.
Well, yeah. Okay. All right, Jimmy. Who do you like?
I'm from Cleveland. I'm only even vaguely aware of this game of balls and baskets that you speak of. So I'm gonna have to bow out. I've heard rumors of it, but I'm still researching, buffering.
Yeah, all right, Corey. I'm in LA with the Lakers, I can't deal with this at all.
Oh, come on, man. No, what? All right, hey, Corey, help me out here, man.
I'm looking for, first of all, this series is just crazy. The Spurs, Oklahoma City, it's like two heavyweights, it's throwing haymakers, unable to stop each other. It's like a Rocky movie, a good one, one of the early good ones, but. I'm actually rooting for the battle of MVPs in the finals. Heat versus Thunder, LeBron versus KD. No offense to the Spurs, but they're just boring. So if you're gonna beat champions, At least give us some swag, a little flair to it.
It's kind of yeah.
Do you think, four NBA store, championships is not swag? I'm just going to put that out there. I mean, 99, 2003,
that's
2005,
swag.
That's not swag.
That's not swag. That's excellence.
You know, we're used to that here in Pittsburgh
with
six Super Bowl championships. We know about what real swag is, which is why you're going to see the Spurs and the Heat in a rematch. And if it wasn't for Ray Allen hitting a fluke shot in the corner after the ball bounced, the way the Spurs would have had a championship last year, too. So it would be very interesting.
Hey, man, I'm greedy.
Rematch.
I want swag and excellence. There you go.
Lenny, who do you like?
The Miami Heat.
Who do you
It's going to end up being the Spurs in seven, if not in six, and it's going to be the Heat. And it's going to probably be Spurs-Heat going seven games again.
And who do you think for the outcome? Who do you like for the championship?
It's going to be the best small forward in the history of the NBA taking the MVP once again. That's LeBron James.
Okay. Anybody else co-sign that? Corey, what do you think?
Yeah. LeBron James?
I don't co-sign on LeBron being a small forward because he plays all four positions. The best one to do it since Magic. He'll go down as, you know, MVP if they win, for sure.
Okay. Rick, what do you think?
I agree with him, and I'm still thinking about Dr. Dre, and I'm just so happy for him. I'm just so happy. I hope he calls me.
I hope he calls you. I know. I hope he calls you, too. I hope he calls you, too.
That's all I want. Dr. Dre, call me. Doctor's in. I need help here.
Okay. Rick Nahara is a writer, actor, and producer. He joined us from NPR West in Culver City, California. Lenny McAllister is a Republican strategist and host of Get Right with Lenny McAllister on KDKA News Radio, although he was with us from member station WQED, which is in Pittsburgh. Corey Date is a contributing editor for The Root. He was with us from Philadelphia. And Jimmy Israel is a writer. You can find his blog at jimmyisrael.com. He was with us today from member station WUKY, which is in Lexington, Kentucky. Thank you all so much.
God bless you all.
Yep.
And remember, if you can't get enough Barbershop Buzz on the radio, look for our Barbershop podcast. That's in the iTunes store or at npr.org. That's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Let's talk more on Monday.